Hello and welcome to the Beer Nuts Productions podcast. My name is Goff, and today I am joined by a very special guest. This man has been in the entertainment industry all of his life, and he is currently the head of entertainment at Village Roadshow Theme Parks. Did I get that correct?
Absolutely.
It's Michael Croker. How are you doing today, Mike?
I'm good, Goff. It's a pleasure to be part of the series that you've got going here.
Is it?
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're welcome to be had.
And we've set the tone for everything that's about to follow, right?
Yeah, pretty much, yes.
All right, here we go.
It's downhill from here.
Right.
So, because you have been involved in the entertainment industry pretty much all your life, so how did it all start for you?
I was the odd kid in the family for a little while. Mum and Dad were both Air Force, and Dad was, in fact, a warrant officer disciplinary. That was the title, so you can imagine. And it was always thought, you'll probably go and do the same thing we did. You'll join the forces. But I was looking to do community theatre, community radio. I was writing, I was drawing. And, you know, as young as 15, Mum would drop me off at the local community radio station in Townsville for midnight till dawn shifts.
Okay.
And I would do 5 hours with, you know, a couple of turntables and playing vinyl. And they would come and pick me up at the break of dawn. So I just had this love and this passion for the arts and performance. The dream was to someday work as a professional actor. I auditioned for NIDA, the National Institute of Dramatic Art, when I was 17. Mm-hmm. I think there was about 80 auditionees at that time, going back to about 1987.
Okay.
I made the final four, and they were going to take 2 out of the 4 into Sydney. And made the final four. They put me through the ringer for one final day, and I was let free. I was 17. And I remember the guy sitting me down at the end of the day saying, Michael, there's something there, but you're too young and this course will crush you in the first 6 months. So come back. I still remember this advice he gave me. And at the time, all I was hearing was no. So I wasn't really listening. But over time, I came to love the words. And what he was saying to me at the time, he sat me down and he said, go out into the world, fall in love, fall out of love, get your heart broken, get knocked to the ground. This is exactly what he said. Taste blood on your lips.
Crikey.
Get dirt in your face. Stand back up. Go again. And then see us next year. Of course, I'm listening to none of that. I'm just hearing it. Because all I was hearing was no. Left home, jumped on a bus out of Townsville, made my way to the Gold Coast. I thought I'll do 6 months at a theme park, save some money, go again maybe 12 months. And the rest is history. I fell in love with that business. Began working at SeaWorld when I was 18.
As what?
I was a rides operator.
Okay.
And I would hear these shows happening around me. So I'd be operating the carousel, driving the train, and in between operating the rides, you would hear the joy of performance. Mm-hmm. There'd be dolphins and sea lions and ski shows happening, and you'd hear guests in awe, and then you'd hear laughter, then you'd hear applause. And I remember thinking, that would be a good job. How do I get that? And it was a matter of making myself known to the team that ran that area and the guy that headed it up. And the idea that I could possibly do it was so remote because they saw me as a rides operator and I was referred to as the kid. But I volunteered. So I did 5 days a week as a rides operator and then I did 2 days a week going in, quite literally cleaning the studio, learning how to operate the desk, learning how to mix the shows live. And I was making coffees. I was quite literally just the gopher. And then eventually I pressured a guy who would become a mentor to, please, would you give me the mic? Could I have a shot and perform a ski show for you one morning and let you know what I can do? Let me show you what I've got. And to his credit, he gave me that shot at 18. And I can still remember that day. It's like, it's a vivid 4K memory in my mind. And I went down and I announced a ski show at SeaWorld to an audience of one, just this guy, with, you know, a full cast of 14 people who weren't very happy to be getting up early to do a show pre-park open for some kid.
Yeah.
But they begrudgingly went out and we did a full show. And that day changed my life. I finished the audition that I'd kind of begged for. And the boss walked down, big Canadian guy called Chuck. And he put his arm around my shoulder and he said, hey, welcome to the team, kid. And that was the beginning. So at 18, that kind of lit the fire, and away we went from there.
Now, I want to fast forward because this is something that genuinely interests me because obviously I produce films and whatnot, so I have an understanding. But this, I'm assuming, is going to be completely different. So you've put together, I mean, we fast forward now and you're the big head honcho, but you've put together events and shows at theme parks. You write from scratch, the conception, the production of it, the writing of it, all the way through to the casting of it. And so take us through that process, because this is going to be, it's going to be interesting for me to sort of compare it to how I do things. So I'm genuinely interested from the concept right to completion.
I guess the thing that really changed my life after I'd been doing shows for a little while as an announcer and honing the craft and getting my hours up, getting my 10,000 hours on stage, taking notes every day from the guys I had around me, I started to see opportunity. So, for example, I was looking at how we were doing Sea Lion productions at that point. They were very much kind of what they'd always been from the 70s. There was a bit of a hangover there. This is a Californian sea lion. His name is X. His weight is Y. His breeding patterns are this. His history, his natural history is that. I thought to myself, wouldn't it be great if we could take all those behaviors and somehow put them into narrative and at the same time celebrate the power and the grace of the animal, but built into a plot with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and take people on a little bit more of a narrative journey. So I wrote a thing called The Quest for the Golden Seal when I was 24, and no one was asking for this. So, and I think you'll probably identify with this too. It's that whole thing of in the absence of opportunity, create opportunity. And if you're born to create, you'll find an outlet. And if no one's necessarily asking for it, you'll make a point of looking to create your own funnel. So I wrote this thing on a typewriter over a period of months, and I based it on Raiders of the Lost Ark and drawing on influences out of that original trilogy. I thought, could you take that and then marry that into a quest? And the seals are becoming the leaders of the quest, who are helping their human counterparts attain this thing. And along the way, we discover how powerful they are, how graceful they are, and we find out these lessons about natural history built into a narrative. And I remember writing that first draft, and I pitched it to my boss. And at first it was like, well, what is this? We've got a show. I said, I know, but don't you think it could be more? I said, what are you talking about? To his credit, he gave me an audience with our then CEO and a man who would be someone that would have a big impact in my life at several intersections. He was John Menzies. He was the CEO at the time. He founded essentially Warner Brothers Movie World. He essentially created the Australian Outback Spectacular. So he was an innovator and a former water skier. So he'd come from the grassroots up.
Okay.
So I got an audience with him. I'm giving you the long answer here.
No.
So I walked into his office and he was someone I didn't have a close relationship. I'm like 24 years old. I'm still a kid. And he's the CEO. And my manager has kind of granted me this audience with him. And he's more or less said, hey, John, would you entertain this guy? He's written this thing. What do you think? I sat opposite John in the boardroom. I can still remember my hand shaking because he was like, I've heard you've written this thing. What's all this about? And he had this kind of way of speaking that was very much like this. And what have you got? I said, well, John, I've written this thing and it's called Quest for the Golden Seal. And that's as much as I got out. He's looking at the page and he goes, all right, I'm not an idiot. I've read that. Take me through it. So I read him the script. As I'm reading it to him, I can hear the quiver in my tone and I can see my hand sort of shaking. I'm sure he was picking all that up. I'm in this big boardroom, which I'd never been in before. He's this silver-haired gent, you know, six foot tall. And he lets me read the script and he tells me at the end of it, you know what, there's something there. You've got to go away and you've got to change this. And that thing that happens in the middle there, that's a bit silly, mate, all right? So we'll change that and then go away and come back and we'll see what we can do, all right? So off I went. And maybe he was entertaining me, but I went away and rewrote that thing, I don't know, 20, 30 times, then got an audience with him again and again. And eventually he fell in love with the script, loved the concept. Now it was no longer my idea, and it was something he championed, and the show was built, ran for 10 years. It was running well after I'd left and moved to Wonderland, Sydney, and it had a 10-year life cycle. That show getting across the line changed everything for me because now it was you were being seen with different eyes. It was like, oh, okay, not only can you jump on mic and get down there and do that, you could write, you could produce, and that was the beginning of a series of things from the theme park perspective that I'm still doing to this day with a group of wonderfully talented people around me.
So when we talk about Movie World, which is where you predominantly are at the moment, so let's take an example like, they just had Fright Nights, for example, right? So I don't know your involvement with that per se, but let's say, you know, same sort of deal. We need to make a show to tie in with Halloween. That's important. So, okay, this is, we're going to do this. So the casting process, we need a bunch of character actors. So for anybody out there who might be interested in auditioning for something like this, what are you looking for? When they come in for an audition as a character actor for one of these shows, what are you looking for?
That's a great question. I think we have...
All my questions are great questions.
That's right. It's... The goal with anything like that, whether it's Fright Nights, whether it's White Christmas, whether it's Spooky Nights, whether it's Hooray for Hollywood, DC Superheroes and Supervillains, Carnival, we're always in pre-production, mid-production, or post-event debrief at any time through the year. Then there's the day trade business that's happening at the same time.
Yep.
So there's two kind of businesses operating at the same time right throughout the year. We've actually had a number of people that I think have crossed your orbit, people like Craig Ingham.
Oh, yeah, I know.
And the list goes on.
I know quite a few.
Yeah. When we're building those events, our brief, before we even get to the casting process, the agenda is really simple with all of that content. Keep people, I say this all the time to the team, our brief is to keep people in their bodies and out of their heads. So what does that mean? You want to keep people feeling and having a sensory experience. Mm-hmm. It's like watching a good film, right? You don't want to be taken up into your head where you start to question the choices of the actor, the choices of the director. You suddenly snap out of the film and you find yourself very aware, oh, I'm watching someone's film,
yeah,
rather than, no, I'm invested because I'm in my body.
Yep.
And then when I leave the theater, I might go to my head and then start to get analytical and critically think. But in the first instance, I just want to feel. I want to escape. And for us with those events, it's the same thing. So the minute you walk into the park, the whole idea is we want to keep you in your body feeling. So I say the same thing to actors every year at the casting process and once they're even selected, to the point that people who have worked with me for years almost eye roll, because just as surely as water is wet and sky is blue, there are certain truths, right? So I say to the actors, this gig is only about three things. So don't overcomplicate it. Intention, energy, engagement. That's it. Now, what does that mean? What's your intention? Do you know why you're on the street? Do you know why you're walking toward that location? If you don't know why you're walking, then what are you doing? And we'll see it as an audience. Oh, that's just someone dressed up in zombie makeup, if it's Fright Nights,
yep,
biding their time. Or is there someone there that's made choices that we may not be completely aware of, but inside, that actor's made choices. My injuries were sustained after a car accident where my left shoulder was broken and my right ankle snapped. Okay, well, that informs now my gait, my movement. And I'm walking from this end of the park to the other end of the park looking for my daughter. I mean, I'm making all this up in real time, right?
I understand.
But make a choice.
Yes.
And I'll say to them, I'll be able to see and the audience will intuit if you've made no choices,
yeah,
because there'll be dead eyes.
You'll be going through the motions.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'll go to my head and ask, well, what's that guy doing?
Yeah.
What's happening there? But I want to feel something. Then in order for me to feel, you have to have an intent. So we'll say to the actors, the first thing is have an intention, always have an intention. You don't even have to articulate it to us, but have your intention just like you would have in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing then is energy. What is the degree of energy you're bringing to that intent? There has to be a degree of energy beneath the intention in order for us to engage.
Absolutely.
So I'm not going to engage if I don't feel or sense you've got clear intent and I don't feel or sense that there's an energy around you. I'm more likely to pass you by. So the idea and the challenge then is to take that simple theory and then multiply it out for a cast between 250 and 300 people over 9 shifts.
Yep.
So it's no small achievement to be able to consistently do it well. So your selection process has to be rigorous. And I often say to our team, higher attitude, coach skills. You know, if we can get the right attitude and the right desire,
yep,
molding and shaping and directing becomes much easier. But if you're fixed, this is what I do and I've landed, there's nothing for me to learn, my tools are already here in my kit, we'll sense that at audition.
Because I mean, on a selfish level, you want to keep the punters engaged for as long as you can so they spend more money at the theme park and you keep your job. So, like, essentially, I mean, on a base level, the point is to entertain the folks, to keep them there as long as humanly possible. So you need the cast to, as you say, be engaged with the audience. Otherwise, the audience is going to go, fuck this, I'll go next door to the pub. And you don't want that. You want them there. You want them enjoying themselves and having a good time so that they stay there and ultimately spend more cash.
The best note I ever got as a young actor, I was in Sydney, and I was taking classes with a fellow that, his name was John Mildren, and he was a NIDA lecturer, and he was running these master classes in monologues. And we were told, you know, John's very upfront, he's very honest, he's very direct, and he's uncompromising. But when you take a class, you're going to come out wiser, and he won't dance around it. So I can recall, for example, we're sitting in this workshop space in Randwick, all a little anxious. I'm in my early 30s, one of the oldest people in the room, and the average age then was maybe between 20 and 26. I felt a little bit out of place, but I'm sitting in this room. I had my monologue down. It was from a play called The Father We Loved on a Beach by the Sea, I think it was, and it's a son sitting next to a dying father and kind of letting out years of conversation of all the things we should have talked about. So it's a wonderful monologue. And one you can really get your teeth into, right? So I'm locked and loaded for that. This one young guy gets up and does his piece, and we're all sitting in a circle. I'll get to my point. This one young guy gets up, does a piece which is quite good. I remember he had a great look about him. He had like a home and away neighbours look, which I don't have. And I thought, oh, whatever happens, he'll probably be okay.
Hey, don't be so hard on yourself,
stop, please.
Don't be so hard on yourself. You know, you're a good looking rooster.
Please, hold me. Hold me. So he does his monologue, and I'm following. So he finishes, and then there's a moment of silence, and we're waiting for the feedback. And John says, okay, I'm just going to ask you something, mate, and I want you to tell me honestly. Is that everything, what you've just given me, is that everything in the tank? And he kind of looked with a smile, and yeah, hey, that's everything. I'm going to ask you this one more time. There's nothing else in there that you think you needed to bring. That's the best of you, the best you could do in terms of choices for what that piece required. There's nothing else that you've hidden away? No, that's everything. Okay, you're chasing the wrong dream. Okay, so have a good think about that. We'll talk later. Michael, you're up. We all kind of sat there, and I've just heard him tell this guy, if that's everything, have another think. So I'm following that. I do my piece. I'm a little shaken, but I get through it. Here's the note that I got, the best note that I ever had. I finish the piece. He takes a moment, he looks at me, very commanding presence, and he looks at me and he says, Michael, I don't know if you're a fine actor waiting to come out or just a good pretender. I'm going to go with good pretender today. Grab a seat. Then next, I sat down and what does that mean? What does that mean? So I had time there to sort of stew on that while I'm sitting. The room clears at the end of the day. We're all making our way out of this hall. He stops me. Grabs my arm, Michael, come back, have a chat. So I went back into the room. He said, that thing I said to you, does it make sense? And I said, well, John, I'm thinking about it. You tell me if I'm wrong. Here's what I think you're telling me. I showed you that I could deliver dialogue. I performed for you. I knew when to push, when to pause. I pressed here, I went there. I showed you my gears and I worked a monologue at you. You didn't feel it and you didn't believe me because I'm not connected to feeling. I'm just showing you that I can recite dialogue. He looked at me, nodded his head and goes, there you are. So next time I see you, I just want to believe you. So in his own way, he's also talking about intention. Mm-hmm. He's also talking about choice. He's also talking about get out of your own way. It's not about you. Be in service to the dialogue. A great mentor who worked alongside him gave me this note in a room with a group of actors once, and that was learn lines, then forget lines, and tune into feelings.
Yes.
It's really that, I think. And I'm not great by any means, but I can understand that thinking. And then I can see that similar thing working in the fine actors that I love. When you come away from a screening or a play and you go, every time I saw you on screen, I believed you.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'm on board.
Yeah.
Now, going back to the actors, like the street performers.
Are we having fun here?
Mate, I'm always having fun. Fun is my middle name. Now, how important for the street performers and also like the cast actors as well, it's a two-part question, how important is improvisation and how can you improve your improvisational skills?
Yeah, that's really good. I talk a lot about the practice of presence and the daily practice of presence. So accepting that the only thing you ever have is the moment that you're in while you're in the moment that you have. But we're noisy animals, right? And I find the best improvisers are the ones who are able to very neatly get into the space between competing thought and sit in it and expand on it. And then the best of us is able to come through. The art of improvisation, I think, is about the practice of presence. And then the tug and pull of being a little bit into the future or a little bit into the past is where the anxiety is and the self-sabotage is on the ability or the inability to tap in to quality improv. And you can hear when someone's attempting improv.
Yes.
And you can also feel when someone is absolutely in flow state, trusting the improv process.
Yes.
Rather than trying to steer it. It's always a little bit dangerous for the ones that know how to do it well,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it almost should feel like it's going to, at any moment, it could skittle off the side of the road. But that's the beauty of the ones that can do it well, where it just feels like, I guess it's the same with musicians. I only just recently saw some musicians play, and they said, we're just going to go into a free jam here at the start, guys, and it's our way of just feeling the room. And I thought, this will be interesting. And the guy on the lead guitar said, we're just going to see what happens here. And then they're looking at each other, and they're having this unspoken conversation by a nod of the head, or I'm looking at where his hand is as he looks back at me and drops down into that. And then as he's finishing a run, the drummer feels the space and finds a fill. And I just thought, I'm watching this improvisation happen musically, and it feels like at any minute it could go one way or the other. And I think the acting improvisation is the same thing. It's a very important part of a thing like Fright Nights.
Yes.
It's a very important part of, I remember auditioning guys that would be playing Superman.
Yep.
And I'll make this very quick. The guys all come in for the casting. They all had a page of dialogue. They all walk in. They're all fairly good-looking guys. They're strapping young men. Again, everyone kind of looks the same off a headshot, right? So
yes.
You kind of know what you're going to get. I walked in. I said to the guys, I could feel the tension in the room a little bit, nervous energy. I said, hey, guys, has everyone got their lines down? And everyone very proudly, yeah, we've got, nodding the head, and you can hear the breathing. I said, well, that's great, because we're not going to do them. So, and it could, again, windows to the soul, the eyes, you could see the looking back at each other. I said, guys, if I handed that script out yesterday to one of our tradespeople, a qualified tradesman, and said to him, hey, tomorrow at 2:00, could you recite that dialogue for me? He could do it. She could do it. No question. That's not interesting. So I'm interested to see, if you're Superman and I'm hosting a late show and you tonight have just saved 300 people from a building collapsing in the central business district, and we were talking about it on late night, how would that go? Grab a seat. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome along to the late show. I'm Michael. I'm sitting here with the Man of Steel himself. And we just started this improvisation.
Yep.
There was a percentage of guys that locked up and couldn't quite.
Yes.
And then there was a smaller percentage that could. Well, thank you for that question, Michael. Let me tell you a little bit about my afternoon.
Yes.
And they went into this thing. And I said to the guys, we will do the dialogue. But when you're on the street, and if Tommy approaches you while you're walking up Main Street and says, hey, Superman, why aren't you flying? And you jump straight into, that's right, I am Superman from the planet Krypton, which was destroyed by, what's that about?
Yeah.
But what you might do is kneel down and look at Tom, say, Tom, that's a very good question. If I was flying today, how could I possibly make new friends like you?
Yeah.
Now, that's just coming to the moment, right?
So what you... So
presence.
I assume as well, I mean, it's a bit of a no-brainer then. It's actually a very clever way to do it, because the dude who's going to get the job is the dude who then will sit down and play out that scenario with you. I mean, it makes your job super easy.
Absolutely. I see what you did there. But
it's true, though, isn't it?
No, 100% yeah. True. And I see a lot of actors that wrestle with something that a lot of people tend to wrestle with, which is self-trust.
Yeah.
That I am enough. There is nothing for me to be more than who I am right now in the moment.
You've got to back yourself in.
Yeah.
Because when you're auditioning, so if it was me, you know, and I'm in front of you doing that. I mean, if I don't back myself in, again, it's what you were saying earlier with the trust and the presence and the energy, all that sort of stuff. It all combines to having, you've got to have confidence in your ability. Otherwise, you know, good, because you're interacting with a whole bunch of tourists from all different walks of life, all different countries.
Some
or different
can't speak your
English levels.
Yeah.
So I mean, you need to be able to back yourself in physically, you know, and also verbally. Otherwise, you know, good to you. So,
and I think the finest actors, the finest performers in any discipline are the ones that can self-trust and quickly and efficiently get out of their way.
Yes.
Because so often we're in our own way.
Yes.
And we're pushing the trying to push the best parts of ourselves through this haze, this slight mist of self-doubt or anxiety. And the best of you just can never come through unless you can go into a place of genuine self-acceptance, make choices, do the work, and then throw the work away and just be present.
Now, that's actually really solid advice and something good to end on, to be honest. But before we do end this interview, Michael, because...
Sorry, I saw you had 10 questions and you've asked me two. Well, I've sucked up too much air here.
It's because you wouldn't shut up. But, see, I back myself in and tell the truth. So I'd be a good Superman.
Oh, that's great.
You know, I don't care if I'm from the planet Krypton. Actually, I'm bald, so I'd be a good Lex Luthor.
Yeah, well, I'm right behind you. Way behind you.
I used to, when it was thinning, I used to tell people they were thigh marks. So you can go, you can tell people that, Michael. It's just thigh marks.
I don't know if I'll take it, but I like it.
Obviously, there are, we don't have time to go into it now, but there are more strings to your bow. So why don't you give yourself a big fat plug? Where can people learn more about Michael Croker?
Well, I work outside of the parks as a communication coach and do quite a bit of coaching on the side. So I have a website, which is standanddelivercoach.com. So that's a website where you'll find out everything you need to find out about me beyond the park business.
Well, yes, and people should absolutely hit up that website because you're full of good advice, as we have just learned.
Oh, please stop. No.
Okay,
go on. How about a little more? Hey, it's been wonderful to sit here with you. And I think at some point there's so many questions I'd like to ask you, because I think the inspiration for you, for other people, other actors is, and again, I don't completely know all of your story, but the idea of going independent and in lieu of tapping into something, you've created something. And you've now got this body of work that continues to evolve, and actors are getting opportunities to cut their teeth and sharpen tools. I don't think there's anyone else that's kind of done that to the degree to which you've done that, particularly in this region.
Well, yeah, no, well, I am Australia's only independent streaming service. That is a fact. Yeah. So, yes, Beer Nuts Productions, which I will now plug very,
it,
very
plug
badly.
Plug it for us, Goff. Where can people find you?
Yeah, they can find me at beernutsproductions.com, the home of the world's greatest entertainment.
Oh, wow.
And that's not overselling it.
I'm logging on now.
As well you should. Actually, you have done a voiceover bit for me, and I am desperate to get you. I actually wanted to work with you last year, but you were down in Sydney doing some hosting duties,
that's
unfortunately,
correct.
So yeah. We couldn't get you involved in that project, but I will get you involved in something else, because you've done a tiny little voiceover piece for me once before in the education system.
Yes, yes.
But we will get you on board with something else, and I'll give you a script, so that way you're contained and you won't take up all of my fucking time. I'm only teasing.
It's funny because it's true.
I'm only being serious.
Yes, yes.
But no, well, thank you so much for coming down, Mike. I genuinely do appreciate your time.
My honour.
And of course, make sure you like and subscribe to the podcast, rate and review, leave a friendly comment. 5 stars is always good. And yes, make sure, as Michael did say, hit up the Beer Nuts Productions website and also standanddelivercoaching.com, or is there a .com.au?
Well, look, it's something like that. You'll find me.
Just Google up Michael Croker and he'll come up. But that brings us to the end. So thank you for listening, and we will talk to you next time.